WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Grifters is the first film British director Stephen Frears has made in America. Vincent Canby wrote in the New York Times that Frears has made a smashing variation on the sort of movie that people mean when they ask why Hollywood doesn't make movies the way they used to. The Grifters is adapted from a pulp novel written in 1963 by Jim Thompson. It's the story of three con artists, Lily, her son Roy, and his girlfriend Myra. The film stars Angelica Houston, John Cusack, and Annette Bening. Stephen Frears first became known in the U.S. with a film about a young gay Pakistani man in England who runs a laundromat. The film was called My Beautiful Laundrette. The story and screenplay were written by the British-Pakistani writer Hanif Qureshi. Frears and Qureshi also collaborated on the film Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. These films led a new trend in British cinema in the mid-80s that broke away from the masterpiece theater version of Britain to show the working-class, multicultural life. Frears also directed Prick Up Your Ears and Dangerous Liaisons. Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet spoke with Stephen Frears about his new film, The Grifters.
How did you end up making The Grifters? Was this your idea? Were you a Jim Thompson fan, or did someone offer you the project?
No, I was offered it as a book by Martin Scorsese, a man I admire more than I can say. And I liked the story, and I understood it, and I think I thought that I was looking to make a film in America, and people used to send me things, and I'd say, well, I'm sure this is very good, but I don't actually understand what it's about. And I think that a book in that sort of hard-boiled style made sense to me.
When you say you understood it...
Well, I understand about cheap paperbacks, and I like all that sort of pulp fiction. And I understood that, you know, that was a way in which you told rather strong stories. I mean, so I responded to that. And it gave me access to American culture, which a more conventional script perhaps wouldn't have done.
It is very much an American story.
It's very much so. Yes.
Con artists, and they spend a lot of time at the racetrack and in bars. Did you have to do any kind of research to learn?
Yes,
about
I don't know. I don't know anything about. Well, I don't know. I know nothing about America. I don't know anything about horse racing. Yes, I don't know what that world is like. I had to learn about it. I say I knew what it was like from the movies, but in real life, I had to learn about it. But people take that stuff. You can learn. You know, you can. People will take you to places and show you how to do certain kinds of tricks and things like that. That's available. Of course, the emotion, the relationships between the characters. You know, that comes from somewhere else.
Well, what did you do to prepare? Did you get people to take you to the
race? Oh, I mean, con men would come in and show me their tricks.
Really?
Yeah, they were and rather nice people, and it was always very funny, and they'd show you how they cheated people.
Did who found the con men?
Well, you never know, but oh well, I know somebody who knows somebody, and they, you know, they I don't know. You know, I'm a film director. I'm somehow shielded from all of that. But if you ask to meet a grifter, they'll find one for you.
So what were some of the things they showed you?
Oh, the magnets up sleeves and, you know, palming cards and three-card Monte, all that sort of stuff. And also that it's all on a very, very, you know, it's for $10. It's not for $100,000. That's big. That's sort of something else. This is just for $10.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the truth is we're all suckers and we haven't a hope. I mean, I know I'm a sucker. I can't live in... I couldn't live with those guys. They could take my money any day.
Did they?
How do I know? That's part of the joy. You never know that you've been done.
Since the characters in this film, they are con artists, and part of the con is that you can't let other people really read your face.
Yes, of course.
And you know, they're very tight-lipped, and they really can't reveal their true selves on the outside. So is it hard to get the actors to reveal their inner motivations to the audience since they're trying to hide it from the other characters in the film? Is it hard to direct a performance like that?
I think I do that instinctively. The last film I made, Dangerous Liaisons, that was quite a problem. That's to say, whenever anybody spoke, they were always lying, and eventually we found a way that you could actually see the dishonesty and the layers of deceit. It didn't so explicitly... It didn't present itself as a problem in the same way in this film. No, I mean, that's... It was about the fact that you didn't know whether somebody was lying or not, and only afterwards did you discover, oh, I see, they weren't saying what they meant at all.
Your films, all the ones that I've seen, have some very serious and sometimes very brutal scenes in them, but then suddenly they'll shift to something that's really quite funny that has jaunty music in the background.
Yeah.
Is that an important element for you, and what are you trying to say with that?
Well, I don't like the nasty bits, if that's what you mean. I mean, I sort of slightly shut my eyes. I hate doing them. It seems to be part of life. Those days aren't much fun. I like it when it's all cheerful. But the films seem to be about people who find life quite difficult. I mean, which includes me, and I imagine most people in the world. And it has a sense of people's struggle to get through life. But people are also very, very cheerful about it and laugh a lot and make light of quite difficult things.
Would you ever be drawn to doing a more fantasy kind of film, though, that's not so realistic?
What about going to the moon? I'd love to. I'm not sure how well I'd do it. I come from a... My training in Britain was to make films which recorded what life was like. And then, you know, then turn them into fiction and make stories out of them, but nevertheless, that life was somehow the basis of it.
Well, my guest is film director Stephen Frears, and his new film is The Grifters. It's based on a novel by Jim Thompson and stars Angelica Houston and John Cusack. Dangerous Liaisons was your first major Hollywood studio production.
Yes.
Right? And before that, the films that you were known for over here were My Beautiful Laundrette and Prick Up Your Ears and Sammy and Rosie Get Laid.
That's right.
And all of those were about class and race and homosexuality.
Yes.
And they were set in these rather nether worlds of London.
Yeah.
So you would seem to have been the least likely choice to direct this major studio production about the French aristocracy in the 18th century.
Yes, that's right.
How did you get that job?
Well, it took them a long time to come to me, though the writer, Christopher Hampton, who was also the producer, he said right from the beginning, the person you want is Stephen Frears. And they said, no, he makes those films, you know, about other subjects. But of course, he was right, because really, what I'm used to is working with very, very good writers, and Liaison was a wonderful script, and I knew Christopher very well, and I understood absolutely what he was writing about. So it wasn't difficult for me. I wasn't surprised, but I could see other people were.
I read that Milos Forman was doing the same story, or he. He was doing
Valmont
at the same time, and I read that every other director they spoke with had turned down the project because they didn't want to go up against Milos Forman.
Well, I had nothing to lose. Since I had no reputation, I wasn't in a threatened position.
What did it mean for you as the director of that film to know that Milos Forman was doing Valmont at the same time?
Well, at first it was rather scary, and I remember thinking, oh, my goodness, I'll make such a fool of myself. The script was very, very good. I mean, that's really what it came down to. The script of Liaison was so good that you always felt confident in that. And then, I come from a world of cheap films. I make films very quickly because we don't have the sort of resources to take a long time. So I sort of knew if it came to a race, I would probably be faster.
So how long did it take you?
Liaison?
Uh-huh.
I was hired at the end of January and the film opened in December. I mean, it was thought to be very, very quick. For me, it was longer than I'd ever spent on a film.
How long did it take Milos Forman?
Oh, my goodness. He started shooting after I finished shooting. And he then came out a year later. So, yes, it took him, 15 to 18 months. In fact, it must have taken him best part of 2 years.
It's Dangerous Liaisons, it's a period piece from the 18th century, and you could have gone the route of doing, you know, making it really opulent with large crowds and a lot of chateaus.
Yes, that was what I didn't want to do.
Why didn't you want to do that?
Well, because I've seen films like that and they don't interest me. And what I always liked about the script was that it wasn't about that. It was just about these people and how they interacted and how they revolved around each other and fell in love with each other or whatever. And that the story was absolutely wonderful, and that if you did put in a lot of sort of French 18th century period detail, that that was somehow not very interesting. And I remember saying to the costume designer and to the set designer, both of whom were wonderfully talented men, I said, look, if people come out talking about the costumes, we've sort of failed. You know, it's the story which is so wonderful.
And you ended up using a lot of close-up shots on the
faces. Well, that's what you were talking about. That's because if you went in close, you saw that they were saying one thing and meaning another. Oh. It's simply, it's a quite practical problem. How do you show dishonesty, or how do you show that someone doesn't mean what they say? And there are several answers. There are several, you know, there's no limit to the number of ways you can do that. But in that film, what worked was going in and seeing their eyes.
A few years ago, you directed Prick Up Your Ears, mm-hmm. and that was about the British playwright Joe Orton mm-hmm. and his homosexual relationship with Kenneth Halliwell. And Halliwell ended up bludgeoning Orton to death, and this all happened in the late 60s in London. And that was a project that you actually had first tried to do back in 1981, and it didn't happen, but you really persisted with it. What was it about his story that you really made you really want to produce that film?
Well, it's an extraordinary story, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, I imagine there were all the way through it, there were themes that interested me, and it was a very, very good script. I mean, they don't float around. When you find one, you're really pleased. I mean, we didn't make it in the early 80s because, you know, the climate shifted slightly in the mid-80s, and we were able to, I think now you couldn't make it, but at that time we were good, and we were able to get the money, and we went back and did more work on the script. So it was sort of, it was opportune. And we couldn't find an actor the first time, and then in the meantime, Gary Oldman, who says that he did come to see me in 1980, but he was growing up a bit, so that when we saw him again in 1986, he was that much older and, you know, had filled out and become a man of the right age.
Did you just say now you couldn't make that film?
I doubt if you could make that film now.
Why is that?
Because the legislation in Britain has become more repressive. And I don't think you could... You know, it was quite an expensive film because we had to recreate an earlier period. And I don't think you could go to somebody and sort of honourably ask them to invest in the film now. It would seem to me that the forces lined up against it were too strong. I mean, there's legislation which... You know, although no one, perhaps you wouldn't get prosecuted, you'd always be nervous that you were going to be prosecuted.
What legislation?
Oh, there's a clause in some bill which makes it illegal to promote homosexuality. Well, I don't know what the words mean even, but, you know, someone might say, oh, this is promoting homosexuality, let's take them to court and cause havoc that way. So, you know, the whole climate is against that sort of work.
I believe there are some similarities between you and Joe Orton. You both grew up in Leicester around the same time.
You made me very nervous when you said that.
Well, Yes,
he was older than I was, but I certainly came from the same town as him, yes.
And did you enjoy putting in a lot of references to Leicester in the film?
Yes, I suppose so. Oh, it was a terrible place. It was a terrible place after the war. I mean, Britain was a difficult place after the war. There was such austerity and hardship. But Leicester was always a very narrow-minded town. And the truth is, you couldn't wait to get out of it. And he got out, and I got out.
Is it true? I think one of the characters in Prick Up Your Ears mentions that Sir Richard Attenborough came from Leicester.
I then met him and challenged him on this, and he said, well, he didn't really... He went to school in Leicester, and when I was a child, he was sort of held up as this model schoolboy, and my life was made a misery because I wasn't in his league, you know. He was what well-behaved children were supposed to be. but he then... He said that he really came from Cambridge, and his father, in fact, was there. He was the vice-chancellor of the university in Leicester. And he was actually rather nice.
I actually heard another story. He wanted to appear in Prick Up Your Ears.
That's right. I said to him, "Oh, I'm from Leicester. You destroyed my childhood. You ruined my childhood simply by inadvertently." He said, "Oh, I'll come and play a man in a lavatory."
And there's scenes of gay men picking up men in the lavatories.
That's right.
That was in London, right?
That was in London. Yes. So it was always based on the research. There was a book published. A man did research into this in some American city. It was an extraordinary book written in very, very academic language about these extraordinary practices with sort of diagrams of where people would stand on the floor. It was incredibly funny that a man had sat there making these notes.
Is this a sociologist?
A sociologist, exactly, exactly.
Did you use that
Or I made it up. I had no idea. I have no idea what goes on in public lavatories.
You studied law at Trinity University?
Trinity College,
Trinity
Cambridge.
How did you end up working in film?
Well, it was very, very boring reading law. I mean, really dull. And while I was at Cambridge, I worked in the theatre a lot, and I thought that I wanted to work in the theatre for a living. And I got jobs in theatres, and then I found it not... I wasn't as happy as I would have hoped. And then I met a film director who said, come and work on my film. So I went and worked on his film in complete bewilderment about what was going on. And then I made a film. And then what happens in life is you discover that people will employ you and actually, you know, pay you a wage to make a film. And so I learnt, as it were, as I went along. And then you one day think, oh, I see, I can actually make these films. Now perhaps I should think about what I make, why I photograph that and not that. And so it was a complete accident, really.
Who was the film director?
Carol Rice.
And wasn't he part of, in France around this time in the 60s, there
in
was...
In Britain.
Well, in France, there was the New Wave,
yes.
You know, cinema.
Yes,
the New Wave.
See
was
what
there
saying.
A comparable thing?
Yes,
going
there
on
was a that? Yes, absolutely. I mean, he and a man called Lindsay Anderson and Tony Richardson—they sort of changed the whole thing. And you know, those sort of rather old-fashioned films about the British stiff upper lip and the middle classes stopped being made, and they started making films about ordinary people and ordinary lives, ordinary social problems, working-class people. And television really picked up from them and started showing life in Britain as it really is. I mean, you know, ordinary life, ordinary, regular life. Not that sort of view, you know, as though life sort of came down from the Queen in some way. Not that sort of official tourist view of Britain. Just the real thing.
Did you want to work in film?
Well, when I came down from university, I wanted to work for the BBC. Around the time, at the end of the 50s, the beginning of the 60s, it suddenly became a place where there were large numbers of young people who sort of had nowhere to go, very, very highly educated, intelligent people who wanted to find some means of expression, and the BBC became where they went to. And fellows who were at university when I was there, they were all getting jobs in the BBC. So the brightest people in the country went to this institution. And they sort of took it over. A few years later, it was the Beatles and, you know, things like that. But at that time, the BBC became, largely when it was run by Graham Greene's brother, it became a place where the very, very bright, energetic, lively people were to be found. And it was the most wonderful place where you were trained to sort of question the system and trained to show life as it really was and trained to be sceptical about official versions of things. It was a wonderful place and a wonderful training ground. I went through you know, a period of 10 years, just making film after film, not comparable to anything that's in America, except maybe sort of independent films, and all because it was a subsidized system. All they wanted was a good film, and I was working with the best writers in England, the best actors in England. It was a fantastic training ground.
What were some of the films that you made for TV, or some of the shows that you made for TV while you were working?
They were a lot of sort of 70-minute films by very, very good writers. I doubt if you wouldn't know what they were. I mean, they weren't things that were shown in this country, although I think the museums showed quite a few of them. But they were done by the best, you know. I worked with Tom Stoppard and people like that, Alan Bennett, a lot. They were where they were writing for. Because you couldn't get into films. Films was a sort of closed world. So young people, people of my age, just took this medium over.
You did make Gumshoe. How did that come about? But then you didn't make another film.
Well, I made that because it's a very, very good script that a friend of mine wrote, and we got Albert to be in it. Albert Finney to be in it. So it was, you know, we got given the money, but I didn't really know what I was doing. Then I went into television. And what I was really doing, although I didn't know this at the time, was finding a place where I could learn my job.
And then My Beautiful Laundrette, which was your next film, actually started out as a TV show, and you...
Well, when I was sent the script of My Beautiful Laundrette, I said, this is very, very good. This is like these television films we've been making, so we shouldn't try to kid ourselves that this is for the cinema. So it went into the cinema by popular demand. I mean, it was a wonderful experience. I mean, you know, we weren't thinking, oh, this really would be good if it was in the cinema. It was suddenly started being shown in New York and in Paris, and it was a complete eye opener to us. We were all astonished.
For that film, also, you were known for presenting homosexuality in a very humanizing kind of way, because
yes.
I think it was one of the first films that had a homosexual relationship in it, but it really wasn't about homosexuality.
Well, it wasn't. It didn't show them to be sort of that it was a problem in any way.
It just came out very naturally.
Yes, yes.
Did you and Hanif Qureshi, who wrote the screenplay, did you discuss how you wanted to present that relationship?
I don't think I ever had a conversation with him. It just evolved naturally. I mean, the homosexuality was in the script, and I remember because it was a radical film. I remember being delighted that you had to be radical on all levels, which included relationships and sexual relationships. And then I discovered afterwards that I'd shot it like a sort of high school picture, and you know, that it was really my memory of American teen films from the 50s. Sort of people necking in open cars and things like that. Boys and girls in the American films. And in fact, without thinking about it, I'd subverted it and made it a sort of parody of that.
Mm-hmm.
It was certainly true that it somehow was acceptable, and I always liked it that it didn't treat homosexuality as if it was some terrible disease.
Okay, well, we're just about out of time. Do you know what your next project's going to be?
No, I have to go and get a job. Why do you laugh?
Just the way you put it sounds funny.
Well, I haven't got a job and I want to get one. but I notice people laugh when I say that.
Well, thanks a lot for coming by today and doing the interview.
Okay, it's been a pleasure.